What's the best way for Hollywood to keep their content from being pirated on the web? The answer to this question and more on this week's Radio Berkman. It happens to everyone. You spend millions of dollars producing your feature film or TV show, even more promoting it, and by the time it hits the screen, already hundreds of thousands of people have gotten to see it on their computers just by grabbing off a peer-to-peer network for free. No ticket sales, no advertising dollars. You've just lost millions in potential revenue. So how do we keep content from being accessed illegally? Shut down the pirate sites? Seems like an obvious answer. Not according to researchers Michael Smith and Rahul Talang. Smith and Talang research business models for media on the web at Carnegie Mellon University's iLab. In 2007, when NBC decided to stop offering top shows like The Office and Heroes on the iTunes Store, the iLab started tracking how much of the previously available content was being downloaded illegally on file-sharing networks. This past April, the iLab released the results of their research, showing that NBC's decision to take their shows off the web resulted in an 11.5% increase in the demand for the content in pirated form. David Weinberger spoke with Smith and Talang to find out more about this research and what lessons the entertainment industry should take away.
So this was an area where we got really interested in how consumers actually consume digital media and what's the interaction between the various channels in which they can consume this content. So we've just finished a paper that was motivated by a lot of quotes in the industry where you had studio executives saying we can't compete with free content, and you know, if there's pirated content, and pirated should be in quotes there, if there's pirated content out there, then consumers won't buy. The idea then is to see if we can find natural experiments where you can look at what happens to consumption behavior, and one natural experiment that we've used in this study is what happened to piracy and what happened to consumption and other channels after NBC Universal took their television content off iTunes, which occurred at the end of 2007. So we have piracy data, we have DVD sales data, and we can go back and look. And the answer is you have all these consumers who were cheerfully buying content on iTunes who couldn't anymore. Statistically, none of them went to DVD sales. None of them went to DVD box sets. There was a very small change in NBC Unbox sales. So the other major digital distribution channel received a very small bump. And then there was an 11.5% increase in NBC's piracy.
How did you measure the 11.5% rise in illegitimate access?
So we went back and we looked at, we took the names of the torrents and we coded them as either NBC television content or ABC, CBS, and Fox television content. The idea is then we use the ABC, CBS, and Fox as a control and measure the difference in the change in piracy versus what we saw for ABC, CBS, and Fox. And the fun thing is the 11.5% is big. And what it means in terms of unit downloads is there's a unit increase in piracy that's about twice as large as the iTunes sales were for NBC before they went off. And I think the story there is kind of a natural one, that you know, when I'm buying, when you're charging me $2, that I'm buying onesies, twosies episodes, when the price goes to zero, that demand slopes downward, and in fact, instead of just getting onesies, twosies episodes, I get entire seasons. And it's worse than that, because then those customers who have downloaded those entire seasons it's very hard to get them back on that same content.
So what do you make of that? Is that unexpected? I have no idea whether that's a lot, a little. I don't have any expectations. What were your expectations? What would NBC's expectations be?
To fight piracy, you had to give people a legitimate channel to purchase. So people pirate not because they're bad, not necessarily because they really want to indulge in these things. It's just because they don't have a choice. Here is at least one evidence which suggests that if you take that legitimate legal choice away from them, then they will resort to some of the illegitimate demand.
And there's no doubt that there are a large number of consumers who are going to pirate irrespective of whether there's a legitimate channel. I think what's interesting is that there is a segment of consumers that if you give them a legitimate channel at a reasonable price, at a reasonably convenient venue, they'll choose to buy instead of pirating. And if you take that away, they'll go back to pirating.
And in fact, think about it. At some level, the challenge is to find who are these marginal people who actually could be converted one way or the other. There are hardcore people who are going to always pirate. There are a large number of people who are always going to buy. I think how many people sit in the middle, and that's clearly a substantial number, but everything gets coated with one thick paintbrush saying that, you know, if you stop piracy, then suddenly your sales are going to basically jump. That's not going to happen because there are some people who are never going to buy it.
And again, I think the natural story here is that when they were using iTunes, they were downloading, you know, one or two episodes. Once they learned how to use BitTorrent, instead of getting one or two episodes, they got entire seasons.
And that is, they didn't get the torrent that is the entire season packed into one mega file. They got it 23 times, 23 different episodes.
The way we count it is on a per episode basis. So in fact, if they did download an entire season, that's counted as 23, or whatever the number is in a typical season.
Do we have empirical evidence of what happens when an NBC turns access back on?
When they turned it back on, there was a decrease in piracy, but it was much smaller, both in percent and in units, than the increase in piracy was. And again, you could tell a story here around piracy being sticky. And once I learn how to do it, and it's hard to get me back. I think you could tell a story about piracy being sticky in the sense that once I've downloaded this content, it's hard to get me back as a customer for that content that I've already taken illegitimately.
What sort of policy outcomes do you see from a study like this?
Some of the problems of piracy are sometimes just market driven, which is the producers or the distributors haven't or didn't do enough to basically make legally available content available. So I kind of go back to that issue that, you know, in late 90s and early 2000, because Napster really made it extremely popular for people to just download music. And there was no digital option available to users at the time other than going to Napster. So, you know, you could complain as much as you want about what people are doing or what people are not doing. The market simply wasn't providing users what they wanted. You know, 3 years later, iTunes came, and look how popular iTunes is now. And you wonder whether if iTunes was there at the same time when Napster was there, whether the level of piracy would have been as large as it was. Some of those lessons are actually being played out in the movie industry, where now movie industry is going exactly the same direction where the music industry was 6 years ago, which is the movies being digitized. So there is a lesson in the sense from a, you know, just from a overall societal, if you think about even a policy making, that look, fine, you can go to, you know, have laws and you can sue people and you can take them to the court, but maybe, you know, just providing them a legal option which is reasonably priced, easily accessible, actually can mitigate some amount of piracy in a pretty reasonable fashion.
So there's a whole bunch of papers in the social science literature that look at Napster kind of as an event. And the story is basically Napster caused a huge reduction in CD sales. And I think the interesting question is what proportion of that reduction came from the fact that Napster was free, and what proportion of that reduction came from the fact that Napster was digital. That is, you know, so the digital channel is so much easier, so much more attractive, so much more convenient that people are going to go there regardless.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Michael Smith and Rahul Talang are associate professors and researchers at the iLab at Carnegie Mellon University's Heinz College. The work of the iLab is definitely worth checking out. You can find more on them and their work, including links to the recent research, at our website, blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. So what goes on in the minds of the captains of the entertainment industry as they navigate the dangerous waters of the web? Daisy Whitney is a journalist and content creator who consults frequently with industry as they try to chart a smooth course onto the web. I spoke with her to find out how industry is figuring it out. How does the industry follow piracy? I mean, obviously they want to know who's getting their content illegitimately, and they want to know their names and addresses probably. But, you know, just as an audience for them, how are they following piracy?
Well, you know, it's actually interesting because there, you know, there has been speculation that networks have leaked some of their own shows onto pirate sites to see how they do. And there was a lot of speculation recently that the leak of the Fox film Wolverine came from, it was an inside job, people said. These companies have vast anti-piracy groups. I mean, they have really funny names. I interviewed somebody who's the IP Council and head of worldwide anti-piracy operations for Warner Brothers, which is sort of an entertaining title. We got, you know, we all got a laugh out of it. But it sort of speaks to the fact that this is a very serious thing for the content providers, and that, you know, that they've not only have their IP Council and folks who send out the letters and people who have to understand sort of the broader legal implications, but also just the people kind of on the ground who are going out to these sites and tracking them and, you know, contracting with, you know, research and online measurement companies to understand how extensive it is.
I'm curious, because there's got to be some sort of, you know, networks wouldn't want us to know these like kind of industry inside secrets about how they're monitoring piracy, because, you know, then maybe the pirates could game them or.
Right. I mean, that's like everything. I mean, certainly I operate on a much smaller scale, but sometimes people will ask, you know, who are my clients and what publications I write for. And I don't name them all because I don't want other reporters to necessarily know people who you necessarily know who my clients are, because you want to protect them. Not that it's secretive, but you kind of, you got to protect your livelihood. And, you know, a lot of friends of mine who are running small media companies, I mean, they don't name all of their advertisers or customers. You can figure it out if you watch content or whatever. But I think that, yeah, it just kind of speaks to there's a need to be careful in any type of business. I mean, I'm all for transparency to a certain degree, but not to the degree to which it would harm your business. And sometimes it can harm your business by revealing who your clients are or your advertisers. And at other times, it's going to harm your business and your strategy by showing your hand. So I think that's, yeah, that's just sort of the nature of the beast in business, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, that actually brings up something with regards to, you know, Hulu and their interaction with content providers. The way Hulu is run seems to be run as a corporation, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is the head of Hulu is very open about his feelings about, you know, how what content gets distributed and how whether they're able to show their content on Boxy and stuff like that. And that's very similar to a lot of other companies like Twitter and Facebook and how they kind of interact with their users. But the is it something where the content providers just aren't used to this kind of new world of having such a close relationship with their audience?
I think there's a big push-pull in the area that you said in terms of transparency. And I think while transparency is generally a good thing, I think you can't always share everything. And if that makes me sound old school or old media, so be it. I mean, there are just certain details of projects or whatever it is that you can't share for whatever reason. I think that companies that are operating on the web are trying to figure out what those lines are for them, what they should share, what they shouldn't share. And they're probably generally, if they're coming from big media, going to err on the side of caution, because that's how big media has traditionally operated. As consumers, we might want more information, knowledge, insight, accessibility, but probably not going to get as much as we want. And they're going to give as much as they're comfortable giving without worrying that they're going to get into hot water or lose business from doing so.
So it's just in terms of how they're used to operating. I mean, is this just merely trying to migrate over to the web, or trying to retain a sense of how the business works, or just retain the old school business practices and exploit the web as just another market?
Well, I don't think we really know how we're all supposed to behave yet online. And there is more transparency, as we've been saying, and it is regarded in a lot of cases as a good thing. But sometimes it's not a good thing. And I think that's what just we're trying to figure out on Twitter. I mean, is it any different than making a decision not to drunk tweet? I mean, I sort of make it a personal policy. If I have a glass of wine, you know, the Twitterberry goes off. You just have to, I mean, that's my own personal policy. I mean, we all sort of have to figure out what our boundaries are. I'm trying to speak sort of both individually and for corporations. And I think that's what's happening too, as we get deeper and deeper into the web. I mean, isn't that what we're all learning on Facebook and social media sites? Do we need to say, say, if we just changed our underwear. Well, probably not. People probably don't need to hear that. And I think you can extrapolate out from that about what media companies and independent web producers are experiencing too. If you have a really bad day and had a bad phone call with a client or an advertiser, and your instinct is to call your friend or your partner and kind of vent with them, that's still probably the best instinct instead of Twittering it or Facebooking it. Because then how does that make you look? You kind of look like somebody that complains. And you know, like I said, take that a couple steps further. I think media companies are figuring out for them how much to interact with consumers directly. You mentioned Hulu. Hulu does a great job responding to tweets about the service and to technological questions, which is a really smart use of Twitter. And also to responding on comments posted on its site from users. I think those are smart strategies. But yeah, I think everybody is figuring out what the boundaries are for personal and business operations now that the walls have come down much further on the internet.
One view is that Hulu, or any media company for that matter, doesn't necessarily owe anything to its consumer. But, you know, their interaction with the consumer is an enhancement of that relationship with the content. And it'd be interesting to get a perspective of what the SOPs they're developing with regards to Twitter, with regards to following up on comments, what those kind of actions are.
Well, I certainly, you know, I do the best that I can to follow up when somebody writes to me about TWiM, This Week in Media. And, you know, I'm obviously a one-person shop, so that's different. But I think every company that's on the internet now is developing a Twitter strategy, a social media strategy, and figuring out how to respond, because the days are gone when you could not respond. And the fact is, you should respond, and it benefits you. I am an avid reader, and I still get a kick when I friend up an author on Facebook and they friend me back. Probably sound like a kid, but sometimes that's how I feel. And I think that's a good thing. And that's why there are these mechanisms that we can now interact with people, stars, celebrities, minor celebrities, web celebrities, and then the companies themselves too.
And one benefit of that, it seems, just in regards to piracy, is that if you have that relationship, if you've spoken, if you had a response to a complaint or a comment from the corporation or the media company, you know, maybe that consumer is less likely to pirate your content or put your stuff up on a sharing site or something like that. I mean, you see that with Nine Inch Nails and with Radiohead and stuff like that, that people are willing to voluntarily actually pay for stuff.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think when you can strike direct relationships and have conversations, that probably will make people feel a little bit yucky about wanting to steal your stuff. So that's that. To tie it back to piracy, that's a great point. And I think that's another reason why it's important for media companies to reach out and interact where they can, because for many consumers, that will engender goodwill.
Would that scale?
That's the issue that we're figuring out. I think about somebody like Gary Vaynerchuk, the host of Wine Library TV, and he aims to answer all of his emails. I imagine for somebody like him, who is a real star, not just on the web, but outside of the web, that's becoming increasingly difficult. So I think, and I'm not speaking for him, I'm just conjecturing here that it's becoming extremely difficult as his fame and reach continues to grow. It's going to be tough. Is a media company going to be able to answer every email? No, probably not. So it's not going to scale one-to-one. It might scale in a different fashion, though.
Daisy Whitney is the host of TV Week's New Media Minute, This Week in Media, and a new media expert. You can find more of her work at her website, www.daisywhitney.com. No need to fire up the peer-to-peer networks, because you can find links to content from all of our guests, a back catalog of Radio's Berkman, and more free content than you can imagine at our website, blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. Thanks to all of our guests this week, and also Ramaya Krishnan and Brian Tamburo of the iLab at Carnegie Mellon University. This episode of Radio Berkman was produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University.